Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the nation's capital, it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry, with host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Quintessential Listening Poetry. My very special guest tonight is Derek Weston Brown. Derek, are you with me?
I am. Good evening. How you doing?
I'm quite well. And yourself?
Hey, I'm pretty good. You know, thank good. You for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Let me ask you a question before we begin.
Sure.
What is poetry? What is poetry?
It's interesting. Depends on what day you ask me.
Okay.
I mean, being that I'm a teacher, but one of my favorite poets, and I would say, even though I never got a chance to study with her, but still her impact is felt, is June Jordan, the poet and activist. And she talked about what is poetry. There were pretty, like, three pieces of criteria that she would talk about. She had this book called Poetry for the People, and it's like a critical way of bringing poetry to people. And so her guidelines for critiquing the poem, one of the things she said about poetry, she said poetry is a medium for telling the truth. Poetry is the achievement of maximum impact with a minimal number of words, kind of like the economy of words, and then utmost precision in the use of language, hence density and intensity of expression. And there's more of that, but I feel like if you want to go kind of textbook, I really like June Jordan's breakdown of what a poem is or what poetry is.
Well, why do you believe that poetry is important?
Oh, goodness. I think of so many ways in which people tell stories, because I come from a family of storytellers and readers, and I love to read. But poetry definitely is important, if not for anything, but it gives folks yet another way to speak that is pretty unique to any of the other ways and mediums in which people can communicate. But poetry, to me, is the one that is like most definitely the shapeshifter. You know, it can actually be molded and moved and can go into so many different directions. But at the same time, it's unique from fiction. It's unique from prose. And there's so many ways in which you can write poetry. You know, that's it. Like with many other genres of writing, there's always another way to put a poem together, and that's the awesome part about it. It's infinite. It really is.
Yes. Well, let me ask this question: what sparked your initial love of poetry?
Oh man, I think the project just goes back to storytelling. I think I'm an only child. And so, though I had, you know, a healthy number of friends, I had an active imagination. I loved reading. Both my aunts were, one was a school librarian. Another one ran a public library branch. So, you know, books were there. And I loved storytelling. But I'd have to say just something about poetry kind of, for me, was a connection of the best of both worlds, especially finding out about poetry primarily through theater, through the African American Children's Theater, this program that was started in Charlotte back in the early 80s, because there really wasn't any children's theater programs that had plays and skits for black children. And a black parent, educator, artist, Barbara Terman Ferguson, started that theater group, and I was a part of it, and they would make plays. You know, artists would come through and help and work the staff, and a lot of the pieces that we learned to recite within the plays that they built were poems. And so I already liked theater. Theater was my first love, but then you put poetry in there and you could perform it, and mm-hmm. so it worked. So, you know, learn about Langston Hughes and Claude McKay and the Harlem Renaissance poets, and then I'd go to my aunt's library on weekends when my mom was working, and my aunt introduced me to my main man, Shel Silverstein, and I was just like, oh,
yes.
These are poems with, you know, the hilarious or weird illustrations, and then the poems that rhymed, they could also be converted to songs, and I really was like, okay, I like this. As a kid, this wasn't mm-hmm. the boring poetry that I know a lot of people probably got introduced to when they were younger in classrooms, but the presentation I got made me excited. You know,
Wait.
And there's also fun in there. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's turn it over to you. Please share one of your works.
Okay. Oh, man. I guess I'll start with really the opening poem from my very first collection of poems that came out back in 2011 on PM Press, Bus Boys and Poets Press. My book was called Wisdom Teeth. It is called Wisdom Teeth, and so this is a poem called Hourglass Flow. All right. Opens with a quote from one of my favorite rappers, MF Doom. To write all night long, the hourglass is still slow. Flow from hellborn to free power like Bilko. MF Doom. Blame comfort. Blame a city of coffee houses and lounges. Blame ego and pride and all that clever shit. Blame self. Blame the crafty inner only child and his addiction to pleasing and head pats. Blame the anxious inner prospector and gold fever. Blame the voice that wants to sound like a poet, but not sound like a poet wanting to sound like a poet. Blame distractions. But again, that brings it all back to self, doesn't it? Blame ritual. Blame fear of failure. Blame the voice in your head that doesn't like you. Blame competition. Blame loathing and book deal envy. Blame the workshop in your head. Blame expectations the size of a pig iron plow. Blame clock faces in our hands. Blame stuck keys and humming hard drives. Blame that lost hour of slumber. Blame unreadable REM sleep scribble. Then remember the ritual of trying, falling, to get up and dust off, to look to see if anyone is watching, the start over, the hopeful ending. Remember each day is a draft. Remember possibility, process. Remember place. Remember voice. Patience. Remember to forgive yourself. Then you write. That's the end.
What are some of the predominant themes of your work?
Let's see. We're talking about like today, now.
okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely predominant themes. Probably growth. Definitely a lot of forms that deal with the observations of people and just how we interact. Definitely vulnerability and how that relates to masculinity. Also humor. And then definitely I think if you're a writer, a poet, you got to critique the society around you. Sometimes the critique is, you know, it's humorous, and other times it's sharp. And
yes.
I also focus on, you know, aspects of race. And also now, you know, as I'm getting older, I think about this book came out 2011, you know, I was a 30-something poet. And now I'm a 40-something poet. And so now I'm writing about age and you know, how your body adjusts and changes. And
yeah, there are changes.
You know, you can and you can move fast, and then other things you're like, I used to be able to, hey, what happened? What's that? I forget that thing. It's a little joke from an ABC cartoon thing. It says, when you get up and go, it's got up and went.
Right.
So I don't think that's happened yet, but still, you know, I'm like, oh, shoot. You know, what's happening? I don't have that extra stuff. But then I have a poem called Old Man Strength from a chapbook I put out back in 2006. And so it's interesting talking about, like, you know, what's the difference between old man strength and, you know, the limitless young man energy that you got. So, yeah.
Well, would you be willing to share it?
Okay, I have to.
Old Man Strength?
Old Man Strength, now I gotta go find it. So,
okay.
That's all good. But let's see, it's in a chat. It's my chat book called Wisdom Teeth. And I generally keep it in my own little personal library, and bam, here it is, found it. You
fantastic.
Know, just walk right into my library. All right, Old Man Strength. We're going back. Gosh, this poem's like, 13 years old. All right, Old Man Strength. All right, being old don't make you no fool. You don't see a whole lot of young wise men. Shoot, they out there. If they out there, they deader than a motherfucker. Mudbone, Richard Pryor. Sometimes you got to find your way around those young cats, Cornelius Eady. Old Man Strength. One, Miles Davis had to do it. Toward the end, he only peppered his tracks with muted trumpet bursts. Freddie Hubbard, too. You got to realize he was an old geezer by then, and you got to find your way around those young cats that step into the game hungry, cocksure, looking for belts to take, starting spots. Even Jordan did it. Developed a post-up spin-turn jumper and stutter step off the dribble pull-up that still caught Kobe off guard. Drew a foul every time by playing on youth anxiousness. Because you got to find your way around those young cats. Two, I almost fought an older man over a woman once. Stepped to him with bare-handed thunder and lightning, cursing, "Man, I'm going to kick your old ass. You ain't my daddy." I approve that shit then. He didn't even breathe hard when he pulled out his .22. I pulled out my deepest apologies, let the bass air out of my voice like a punctured tire, a shrieking, deflated balloon. "Sir, please forgive my trespass and transgressions. I meant no disrespect. I'll be on your way. Won't darken your doorstep. Excuse me. My bad, sir. Mr. Sir." You see, he found a way around this young cat. Done.
How does Old Man Strength?
Okay, Old Man Strength. Mm-hmm.
But being an old man, I understand. I understand Old Man Strength.
Yeah. I think basketball. The way I could also describe it is, I remember being younger, playing ball, and playing this guy one on one. He's an older dude, and I was running around trying to shoot. Not that I play well at all, but the way he beat me, he just put the body on me. He just put the body on. It was like that. I just couldn't move. You know, I tried to check him. He just, it's like that that weight that I could not stop. He just get his dribble on a little bit, push all the way, you know, push back me into where he could get his hook shot. That's all he did. You know, I'm up here trying to shoot jumpers and all this other stuff. And he's like, he'd be like, check, and then just post up, just push me around. And, you know, wasn't anything I could do to set that slow, steady. I guess you could say it's that wisdom. With the wisdom behind it, like, oh, I already know what to do. Waste stuff out, kid.
For you, how does a poem begin for you, with an idea, a form, or an image?
Oh, gracious. Sometimes I wouldn't even say it's an image. Sometimes a line shows up.
Okay.
And it'll just be something that's repeated, something that pops into my head. Sometimes it shows up as, as dialogue. I like persona poems, so sometimes someone will be speaking. And in other cases, because I love to listen and watch, people watch, sometimes I'll hear a conversation and I'll be struggling to find something to write that conversation down, because sometimes, you know, if you're quiet enough and you're sitting somewhere, sometimes you'll hear stuff you can't believe. You'll literally be like, whoa, am I just hearing this? Okay, let me write this down. And so, yeah, sometimes it comes from that space, or it's an experience, or it's something I see, an article I read. You know, again, stories kind of lead the stories. Sometimes it's personal experience, something that something that may, you know, spark a memory that I may have forgotten, or, you know, kind of kept away. And then one thing leads to another, and I'm reminded. And so I spend time going back over that memory and kind of mining it and putting it into a form that's very much like a poem, something that,
right.
that seems to work on the page.
We'll share another piece of your work.
All righty. Actually, I share this piece of memory with you. And, yeah, you know, my mother, who I see, she'll tell you, if you ever talk to her, she is my, she'll tell people, oh, you know, I'm Derek's first publisher. So I chuckle about that because it's true. But she always talks about the power of memory and about living in the present because she says if you, you know, you're in the present and you're enjoying the time you have, you're also building memory. And she says sometimes being in the present, instead of looking past those moments, you'll miss the really amazing stuff. And so you may look back later in life, you know, if your mind is good, you know, and you'll have this memory. And so this is a memory. And it's a, yeah, it's a past love poem, you know. And I think about this, I think about this woman finally. We're friends and such, but we just had, the time we had, it was great. So this is called Gratitude, a love poem. I think of you the most when I swear the possibility of finding a love feels like a light year. Or when I'm not being so kind to myself and I'm black licorice and backwash and bitter. Or just done with it all after reading this article or that think piece that barks out grim statistics like a carnival barker about algorithms and strategies, and hear ye, step right up and peer at the grotesque facts that you will die alone, unloved. But I think of how we met, all easy bake simple, colleagues, friends that lingered in each other's hushed offices and classrooms, and how we held each other up when the workday was a weight we helped the other ease off of their shoulders. How did we stay so professional? When did this change? I remember it as a pause in a conversation, a laugh shared, and a stare. We actually didn't break. So we just knew, I guess. I didn't miss the blush running under your Maasai-colored cheekbones, just as I'm sure you knew my smile stayed put long after you'd left for the day. To be continued became a letter, became Coltrane's acknowledgement and a licked stamp as wet as his reed. A kiss that flavored a summer and plans and miles and phone calls, actual phone calls and long talks. I know long distance loving better than I know cross town, half hour drive loving. And even though time and life and circumstance means close chapters and simply changing nothing more. When I find myself a bit lonesome, or my memory plays a syndicated series of past disappointments, and my bad case of impatience starts flaring up, I think of how the sweet often rises from everyday unnoticed things, or our arpeggios of laughter that led to blooming, and I'm grateful for simply possibility. Done.
Wow. It's beautiful.
Oh, thanks.
Beautiful piece of work. Well, let's take a brief break and we'll be right back.
All right.
Michael Anthony Ingram. I'm here with Derek Weston Brown. This is Quintessential Listening Poetry. The call-in number is 646-787-1631 if you have a question for Derek. Derek, all great writers, performers, have great writing influences, and I think you may have mentioned some of them. Who are some of yours, and what makes them great in your eyes?
Okay. Man, I'd have to say when I think of writers, and again, I'm not just going to talk about poets in general, but just like it's across the board. So whether we're talking about, I think of Sonia Sanchez especially, and just her ability to, you know, her longevity of work. And I'm a big fan of the haiku. And so
yes,
she's one of my faves as far as a master of haiku writing. I also think of, I know you're from you're from High Point, North Carolina, and
yes,
there's also another poet from North Carolina. I don't think he's from High Point. I want to say maybe Mount Olive. I could be wrong. I might be messing up the small towns in North Carolina. But Leonard D. Moore, one of the few black haiku masters.
Wow.
You know, in states and such. And so years ago, like 2007, I got to go to the North American Haiku Conference, and both of them were there, and it was just so cool. And but other writers as well, I definitely got to, you know, give shout-outs to, I think Tim Siebel is one of my favorite poets as well. Nikki Finney, just with her writing and how she just, yeah, I can't even explain like just her amount of writing. But when I'm on the spot, that's always kind of like, oh shoot, I got to remember, folks. I think of John Murillo, Cornelius Eady, Tony Medina, another Tony, you know, just recently passed, Toni Morrison.
Yes.
If I go into young adult writing, I love me some Alice Childress, Mildred D. Taylor. She wrote the Logan Family series, which was always amazing, like Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, and Let the Circle Be Unbroken. Gwendolyn Brooks, of course. Man, who else? I got to shout out my best friend and awesome poet, Alan King. I think about, you know, writers now, Bettina Judd, Patricia Smith. I think I may have mentioned John Murillo also earlier. Gary Lilly, who's also from North Carolina. I think he's from Sandy Cross, and he's actually in Washington State, like Seattle.
Okay.
So, oh goodness, so many folks. Bianca Spriggs, who's from out of Kentucky. Amanda Johnson. Gracious. If you're talking about D.C., I got to shout out, even if they were in D.C. or not here now, but Naini Mataka, Joel Diaz Porter, a.k.a. DJ Renegade, Ernesto Mercer, wherever he is, Kenny Cole, gracious. Why am I forgetting Kenny's name? Oh, someone who's listening is going to be like, Derek, I can't believe you messed up. Kenny Carroll. Kenny Carroll's name, Ruben Jackson, Kyle Dargan, Katie Ritchie, Bettina Judd. Oh, man, you could go on for a while. A lot of my teachers, when I got my master's in creative writing from American University. So Myra Skaru, yeah, just so many just amazing folks just in D.C. alone. And that's kind of reason why I moved here to pursue my MFA in creative writing because, and I got to say, the writer, Ethelbert Miller, I was interviewing him, one of his memoirs, first memoir when I was a freelance writer back in Charlotte, and we were talking about D.C., and he was like, yeah, D.C. is a great place to be a writer. So I said, okay. Oh, yeah, Al Glover, one of the co-owners of Caribou Books. You know, we can go on and on. So, yeah.
I see.
So, yeah.
I see. You have a lot of influences, a lot of people that you like.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Tell us a bit about your process.
And steal from them. Yeah, yeah.
Tell us a bit about your process. Is it pen and paper, computer, notebooks? How do you write?
Oh man, I have to say that I have been touched by the technology bug, but I generally is etched, and I still write with pen and paper when it comes to me if it's available. But now I'm kind of like everyone else. You know, you walk around with a phone that has all these apps.
Oh, yeah.
So if something comes up, I use the Google Keep app and write some notes. I still try things out on Facebook. I write some things out, you know, and there's, you know, a few folks who are on there will take a look and see what's happening, and I'll see what, you know, what they're thinking about with the piece, and then I'll probably copy it, paste it to a Word document, and then I, in some cases, promptly remove it from Facebook. You know, mm-hmm. It's up for a little while, and then I take it with me. But the mm-hmm. process is just wherever I can get my hands on with something to write, I do it. And there have been some times I've been driving. It doesn't happen often. And something comes, and I'm like, okay, I got to pull over because I'm going to lose this thing if I don't pull over mm-hmm. and get it down somehow. When I worked at a couple of bookstore jobs, when I should have been working and keeping an eye on stuff, you know, sometimes that's the best time. Poems come, you're on the job, you're like, I know I shouldn't be doing this, but I'm going to go ahead and work on this poem, even though I'll probably get some heat for it. But
you know, with all that you've accomplished, do you think that you were meant to be a poet?
Oh, wow, good question.
Well, thank you. That's why they pay me the big bucks to.
Oh, man. You know, I think I was meant to be a storyteller. And in that sense, poetry is under that umbrella. And I think I was meant to be a communicator because as an only child with an active imagination, sometimes mm-hmm. at certain times my mother was my only audience, but I'd say I'm probably like 60% extrovert or 40% introvert. So, there's a point where I love to entertain. So my mom fed that. So I think the poet and the performer, you know, were all kind of mixed in. But poetry is probably my primary way of communicating. But now, you know, also I've been a teacher for the last, you could say, probably like 16 years. And so that is also a performance in itself. And it's also communication because now it's passing on what I've learned, you know, to others. And that, to me, that's also a preparation. You know, what I learned from the stage, you know, what I learned in the classroom, you can do both. How do you get people engaged and involved in something called poetry, especially if they've been introduced to it and it's like, I don't know. I like broccoli, but, you know, after a while, broccoli kind of smells. You know, mm-hmm. if it's not presented right. So I think sometimes people present poetry like, here's poetry. And people are like, I don't want to touch that. That's,
that's true. I like that.
Bland
I like that
broccoli,
analogy.
Man. I'm,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We'll share another piece of your work.
All right. Let's see. All right. So we talked about influences and such. So this is a piece after the poet Angel Nafis. She has a poem called The Black Girl Plays The Dozens with Dr. Seuss. So I wrote a piece called Black Boy Slap Boxes with Dr. Seuss after Angel Nafis. All right. Black Boy Rough House. Black Boy Mean Mug. Black Boy Half Smile. Black Boy Crossover. Black Boy Cross-Eyed. Black Boy Handles. Black Boy Bars. Black Boy Barred. Black Boy White Outline, Black Boy Cheat Code, Black Boy Cheat Death, Black Boy Black Ink, Black Boy Pinned, Black Boy White Sink, Black Boy Heart Sick, Black Boy Corner, Black Boy Amen, Black Boy I Mean, Black Boy Nah Mean, Black Boy Swings, Black Boy Slings, Black Boy Rope Song, Black Boy Hoop, Black Boy Wait, Black Boy Minute Hand, Black Boy Hour Hand, Black Boy Always Late, Black Boy On Empty, Black Boy Reloaded, Black Boy Porch, Black Boy On Stoop, Black Boy On Wee, Black Boy Bag, Black Boy Mama, Black Boy Fade, Black Boy Get These Hands, Black Boy Envy, Black Boy White Bulb, Black Boy Spotlight, Black Boy White Mask, Black Boy Veiled, Black Boy Tongue, Black Boy Musty, Black Boy Barber, Black Boy Barter, Black Boy Tooth, Black Boy Naps, Black Boy Twerk, Black Boy Pocket, Black Boy and Sons, and Sons, and Sons, and Sons, and Daughters, Black Boy Broken Lute, Black Boy Loom, Black Boy Pocket, Black Boy Punchline, Black Boy featuring niggas, Black Boy, Black Girl, Black Boy Loves, Black Girl, Black Boy Mirror, Black Boy Got Jokes, Black Boy Token, Black Boy Meets Turnstile, Black Boy Second Line, Black Boy Closed Curtain, Black Boy Laugh, Black Boy Sheets, Black Boy Stroke, Black Boy Border, Black Boy Aesop, Black Boy Fabled. Done.
Wow. You know, the one line that stands out as I'm just kind of processing just on the top of my head is Black Boy on Empty. Because you can run on empty.
Yeah.
And who's there to fill you up?
Yeah.
To help you keep
yeah.
going. I mean, especially
yeah.
everything that's happening in the world with young black boys feeling as if you're on empty. That's a terrible
mm-hmm.
feeling.
Yeah. Or not being able to admit that you're on empty. That's the thing.
Oh, yes. Not being able to admit.
Yeah.
That's even yes. I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
What
yeah.
makes a poem good?
And so you had me going back to back to June Jordan. Because I you know, when I'm using her to teach things, like she talks about what is a good poem. I'll say, before I even jump into June Jordan, for me, if the poem can somehow touch and affect you, you know, affect somehow you utilize all of your five senses. Like if it has a type of degree of vivid imagery and somehow is able to utilize those five senses and touch you to a point where you feel like the poem is taking you there,
yes.
or taking you to a place you weren't expecting, or if when you walk away from the poem is with you. There's a part of it that's left with you, so you're still thinking about it a few days later or a week later, or you find yourself going back to that book. You find yourself maybe sharing that poem with someone else. Or maybe you just keep it to yourself. Sometimes I think that's kind of the effect of that poem. What makes a good poem? Oh, man. I think of strong descriptive words. I think poems that they're not going to give you all of the answers. You know, sometimes, you know, the poet don't have to explain everything to you. But sometimes a good poem leaves you with yourself to kind of fumble with the meaning. And sometimes, you know, realizing that sometimes you understand that what the meaning that you take from the poem is yours alone. Because I know me, there's been times there are poems that I love and I love them for particular reasons. And then now knowing poets, you know, well as I know them now, to be able to talk about poems, and they're like, well, this is what this poem was meant to do. This is why I wrote it. But then I'm like, well, this is what I got from it. You know, that might have been your intent for the poem, but this is what I got from it. And so I think that's what a really strong poem is. You know, it does something to you. Sometimes it moves the masses, moves the people. Sometimes a really good poem can be sung. So,
mm-hmm. Well, share another
yeah.
piece of your work, and they're all good poems. Share another piece of your work.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Will do. Matter of fact, and this is like I talked about moments. So this is a moment that happened. I had a nice gathering with some of them. Good friend over at my good friend Alan King's house, and this is just newer poem called Poets at a High Table with Wine. We're at this high table and the party is winding down, and it has been a while since I've been at a table of poets, and it's five of us, four men and our sister poet who brought the baddest two bottles of Verdi that would make your taste buds blush. And the talk turns to love, black-white love, and the seesaw of black fates and faith in this day and age when analog is a whisper to digital and all things touchpads swipes. And maybe it's because of the wine or because we know each other as well as we know our stanzas, but vulnerability takes the sixth chair at the table. And we're all talking about perception and relearning and reprogramming this trash dance we were taught where both parties struggle to lead. And then that specter of self-doubt that rides black men like the hag creeps into the conversation. And all of us speak on the struggle of worthiness. and our sister poet, Melanie, nods her head at the tragedy of it all when insecurity becomes a mask and a prison, and black men never reveal their real selves, and suddenly the need to maintain becomes self-sabotage, and possibility becomes ash, becomes absence, and unreturned phone calls. And I speak on my own reconstruction and how I have learned to get out of my head when the doubt fills my ears like a turbine engine's roar so loud that I miss the simple things, the simple asks of women. And Melanie says, this is the other reason why we have to believe women, because they truly will tell you what they want and need from you. And that need is as fierce as my own need to feel safe in the company of a woman and admit it. And who knows where the convo went after that. There was a pause and more wine. And like all poets do, we paused, then filled the open space with fresh words. Done.
You know, they say that to see the world with complete honesty, one should look to comedians, artists, and poets. What do you think emerges naturally from your work? What emerges naturally from your work?
I think humor, definitely desire to be pretty honest. Like, it's taken me probably now to really get to a point of, and when I say desire, not just a desire of the physical, but just asking for what I want. And
yes,
I think that happens more in my poetry and in the way that my poetry has guided me to be able to ask for what I want. And sometimes not even ask, but just say what I want. Because there's a time where that was difficult. I had a part of me that's very much like, oh, I got to please, or I don't want to upset the fragile balance or keep the peace. But, you know, a whole lot of us dropping dead because we couldn't say what we wanted, whether that was help or anything else. And so I do think my poems are the ones are where that happens. What else comes naturally? Humor. There's a lot of stuff I find funny. Some of the stuff I find funny is weird. And that's all right, because that's the realm where I can do that, because my poem, and I wrote it, so shut up. So, there's some things I write about when people are like, oh, I didn't expect that. And like, well, this is, yeah, that's what I do. You know, it's unexpected things. So, yeah, I think that's what comes naturally. You know, what kind of emerges from my poems and such. That's what I can tell you today. And memory.
All right. And memory.
Yeah.
Well, share another piece of your work. I want to hear more.
All right. Thank you. Well, you give me a whole lot of time. I'm like looking at the clock like, okay, well, usually you get post about 30 minutes. And they're like, okay, Val, you need to sit down. But all right. I'm gonna give you this one. This is one I don't think I've shared with anybody.
All right.
All right. It's called A Black Man Writes of Snails in These Times. And I believe, and believe me, I ask the question, why snails? Maybe because they are their own country. Landlords, groundskeeper, loan officer, and home is wrought from the calcium of their molasses existence that says, fuck your hurry up and borders and go back to your own country. I am my own country, an architect, no crowns or kings. Every mollusk, every gastropod or freedom train, leaving mucus trails that glitter constellation winks on leaf skin. And the earth tone pagoda spiraling, always spiraling from their one lung bodies pulsing. Pulmonata, I envy you after every rain, when you stunt all shimmer slick on the lip of concrete streets and wet lawns. I envy you because you're always home. Always your own welcome mat, doorbell, and door slam. We don't want any eyeball retraction. You slow jam snail before the slow jam. You make me want to curl into myself, pull up my mat, and raise up from this world that's been sectioned and parceled so slowly I'd never even be missed. Hello?
I'm here. I'm just processing.
Oh, I said, Lord, I had to, you know, scared you off with a snail poem. I was like, oh, man, you should have read that.
And I didn't hear you say the end. So,
oh, I'm so sorry. Yes, I think I did not say the end. See, look at that. I guess you might threw myself off with the snails, man.
Let's take a brief break and we'll be right back.
All right.
We are back. Again, my name is Michael Anthony Ingram. I'm here with Derek Weston Brown. Derek, I have a question
Hello.
For you.
Yes.
All right, mm-hmm. All right. All poets have several words that come up over and over again, words or sentences that they just can't help but use in their work. What are three of your absolute favorite words to use?
Ooh, good question. Let's see. Memory. Tree. Uh-huh. Yeah,
okay.
Some poems with trees. So, and skin always shows up somewhere. Skin's always going to show up in my poems. So, yeah. It may be a different word. Maybe flesh, maybe epidermis, but skin always shows up. Mm-hmm.
Will you give us an example of a poem with skin?
All right. Will do. All right, actually, this will be good. I'm thinking about Toni Morrison.
Okay.
And so I've been working on, even through my first book, it opens with, I have a section of poems I've been working on based on the characters from Toni Morrison's, you know, masterpiece novel, Beloved.
Mm-hmm.
And these poems are persona poems in the voices of the characters of the Sweet Home Man located on the Sweet Home Plantation. And also Paul D., one of the characters, is in there. So, all right. I'll go ahead. Find a poem that has skin in it. Lord, hopefully it's in there. I think it's in there. I'm actually worried. I'm like, uh-oh, is it in there? Gracious. But I'll read the piece because it does remind me of just different things. All right. Yeah. Okay. I'll share these. All right. So this book's now I'm tripping. I'm like, I know there's a word in skin in here somewhere. All right, let's read this one. This is called What I'm Told, Paul D's Origin. And in the novel, Beloved, Paul D, whenever he came in contact, close contact with a woman, regardless of what she was doing, she started to shed tears. To a degree, it was kind of like his power, something that he wasn't necessarily happy about. Because who wants to show up somewhere and meet a woman and she starts crying?
Starts crying.
All right, What I'm Told, Paul D's Origin. They say when I come along, I was the youngest, the last. When I come, they say my mama burst into tears at the sight of me, couldn't stop. I remember drops feeling like tiny wet fingertips on my face and skin. So I knew rain early. The old woman who pulled me slick and quiet from between my mama's thighs said I was born with a veil on my face. Said that veil was a sign of the charmed. Whoever bare it is a seer, can look into the before, the could be, and the soon come. But my veil, not the kind that calls for a fortune, or the color of that great get-up morning sun. My veil, the color of a work hole, dull and cloudy gray. So I reckon as it is so, my life's supposed to be hard, I reckon. My coming filled with tears, maybe my going be the same, but the damnedest thing, my gift. Mama told me I was special, blessed even, but every woman I come close to weep and moan. Some holler and hold me tight and tremble like a chill done wrapped itself around every bone in their body and seep through to settle in the marrow. Some just twist theyself up like a cloth fat with rain and squeeze out every last tear. They bosoms heaving like a blacksmith's billows do when he fashions his shoes for a mare. I don't shed many tears myself, though I reckon I got cause to. They sold mama around my 12th year. My friends did. Souls. Then I find myself on the block, white hands all in my mouth, tugging my ears, fingers all up and around my nevermind. Then I end up here, at Sweet Home, me, the newest Paul, soon to be the last. You think I'd have a whole mess of tears shed by now? No, I stored away, I stored my heart away where it couldn't never be touched. I keep it buried in the dark of me where it can be dry and quiet, free from all that salty love leaking from women's eyes. But when I come around, they tongue confess. Their hearts empty out onto their faces, and for a moment they turn loose of their pain. Some gift, some blessing. I'm charmed. That's what I'm told. Done.
You know, poets write for a myriad of reasons. Some write poetry primarily to speak a message to the audience. Others write because to stay silent is not an option. Why do you write?
I think part of the silence, I think this is always, not that I fear silence. You know, I think about, you know, the practice of Buddhism and quieting the mind. Sometimes silence
yes.
is a fearful thing, but not so much for me. But sometimes I know when to. Sometimes it's all right to not fill a space with words, right then and there. So I think writing is kind of a meditation for me. In some cases, in other times I think Ishmael Reed has a line where he said writing is fighting. And at the time I never thought of my writing as a fight, but the more I do it, the more I realize that I'm fighting to say things in a way that. Sounds like me, but doesn't sound like me. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does.
So, okay. So, and I think of like the poem I just read, the Paul D poem, or these poems from that I've been writing for Toni Morrison's pieces. And I have to say, I think about my poems I can read and go, okay, there's some parts of me that I can find in there, but these poems come from a different place. The very first one I wrote, I said, this poem sounds nothing like me or anything I've ever written before. And so there are times where I go to a place where the writing is just coming from somewhere else, or I'm channeling something. So, like, I generally read Toni Morrison's Beloved every year because I'm always feeding these Sweet Home poems because there are more to come. But I have to get to a place where I kind of walk away from Derek, and I'm really getting into the persona of these Sweet Home men. And now the poet Ramika Bingham Risher told me, don't just focus on the Sweet Home men. She said, not just the black men. She said, why don't you focus on the men on the plantation? So now that means I possibly have to take on persona of the white enslavers, the white doctor school teacher who is sadistic, or his sons. I got to write in the voice of brother, this rooster. Then there's another poem I actually written in the voice of this tree that Paul D. sets under called Brother Tree. So there's a whole lot of stuff going on. So, yeah, mm-hmm. Sometimes got to step outside myself to get this stuff happening.
Step outside yourself. That's a very powerful thing to say. Step outside yourself. I'm going to need to process that further.
Okay.
Some poets are also very active in other creative areas. What are some of your favorite non-poetry or literature activities?
Okay. Well, quiet as kept. I've always been coming from North Carolina, from Charlotte. So Charlotte it was for a time it was like wrestling territory. That was Jim Crockett Promotions.
Yes,
NWA
I remember Jim Crockett.
Wrestling.
Yes.
Oh yeah. So you know, Ric Flair country. So I like my pro wrestling, man. I still, you know, I know it's scripted. I know it's fake. But it's very much, it's great theater, man. I'm sorry. You can see all the drama, you know, someone's trying to get somebody's belt, you know. And so, yeah, so occasionally, you know, I'll put on some SmackDown or some Raw, you know, and watch that and, you know, chuckle to myself and, you know, and sometimes spend time thinking about, like, what are the plots, you know, what's going on, what's the storyline going to be this day. You know, some people say wrestling is a guy's soap opera, so it's theater. So I enjoy it. I love music. For a time, I was a co-producer and DJ with a show called Soul Conversations on WPFW with DJ YZO and Kimberly Washington. And I still venture on there from time to time to play music, so my inner DJ is there. I also do a little bit of visual arts. I've made a few collage. So I work on some mixed media collage and such. So I have maybe like 3 pieces that I've done, and I'm working on a 4th one. But yeah, that's the thing. Sometimes when the writing's not happening, you move on to other things. I'm making a move to voice acting and doing some voiceover work and a couple of other things that are jumping off. I guess I could say this now. The press that published Wisdom Teeth, PM Press, they just okayed me putting this book into audiobook form. So myself and Alan King gonna get together and I helped record the audiobook version for his first book, Drift. And so now we're about to do the same thing with Wisdom Teeth, so to get it out there. So plenty of things that I do. I love film, love movies. Yep. So yes, all sorts of things.
Well, so it's funny. I was going to mention your speaking voice. You've got a wonderful speaking voice, and I wanted to ask you about the relationship between your speaking voice and your written voice. Is there a relationship?
The speaking voice and the reading voice, definitely. But I think as human beings, we all alter our voices in different ways. I mean,
yes.
My reading voice, I definitely think when I'm doing it, clearly when I'm speaking with the reading voice, that's because I'm conscious of an audience there. My writing voice is interesting because I think it's the starter before I start talking. So that's just, there's different ways I can write, whether I'm writing an essay or writing, I guess text or instructions for my students. So that's also a different voice, but speaking voice, it's always a performance, especially when it comes to a group of folks. So whether I'm on stage, but it's also about how to get people's attention and hold it and working on, you know, the variances of volume and tone and all those different types of things. That's always going through my head. But the time where my voice is probably the most, honest, but just probably the most when it's really just kind of let go is when I write letters. And I'm not talking emails. I just do this thing where I would ask people on Facebook for a certain amount of time, like about 10 people. I said, who wants a handwritten letter? And some people come on like, oh, me. And so I'd write a handwritten letter with the point of you have to write me back. And I do that, you know, to maintain and remember what it is to write letters.
Oh, wow.
You know, that's a dying art. You know, we shoot an email.
Yes, it is.
We get all anxious. You know, we don't get the email returned back. But it's something about, you know, I remember, you know, getting letters when I was younger, postcards or getting a letter. I had a pen pal for a little while as a kid. And it's just something about that process of sitting down with the paper. To be honest with you, Michael, man, I have stationery. So, and envelopes. I got the little wax stamp.
Yes.
You know, when you take the wax and you burn it, I got the stamp.
Yes.
So if I'm really feeling really, you know, Renaissance, man, sometimes, you know, there are a couple people who've gotten letters with a little wax stamp on it. And it's such a joy, man. It really is, getting a letter back or even writing it. And that's where I find myself really, like, just opening up more so than even in my poetry. Because a letter, man, that's intimacy. When you're pushing that pen to the paper and the ink and, you know, you can't go back and erase. So, you know, you just got to go with it. And, you know, after a while, about 2 or 3 letters, man, you know, I look up, it's probably been about like 2 hours or so, my hand hurting. I was like, oh, I remember that. Oh, yeah. So, yeah.
You write letters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Write letters. Yeah. And that's the tradition.
I'm
going to
need to process
from mom. Yeah, my mom, I got to give it to my mom because she wrote the best letters. I think about when I was in camp, getting letters from her. And so I also say that's where part of the poet and writer in me is from. My mom wrote some great letters. And from what I also understand, I've seen some of these letters. My maternal grandfather, her dad, passed when she was very young. But my mom still has the letters that he wrote to my grandmother when he was at the VA hospital getting treatment for the I think a disease he picked up while he was in Korea. But those letters, man, I was like, there's the poet. There's that heart of the poet right there. Like, oh, man.
Share another piece of your work. Share another piece of your work.
Alrighty. You know what? Since I'm going to talk about my dad, so I just talked about my maternal grandfather. I'm going to talk about my dad. Actually, yesterday was the 4th anniversary of his passing. He's a Vietnam veteran. And, yeah, it took a lot out of him. Yeah, and there's several poems, a few poems about him, and they're growing as I go. But this is called At the VA, and this is written about around probably in the last 3 years of his life. At the VA, the man who shares a room with my father titters and jerks under the covers of his bed. His hair is wet and silver corn soap slivers against the pillow. He dances under those sheets like a thick cut of bacon on a skillet lacquered with grease. He calls for his mama. This scares me, and I watch him from my chair where I sit with Daddy. Daddy barely notices. I'm scratching the back of his head, applying lotion to his scalp because his hands don't work. I turn away from the man in the bed who moans, "Cover me, cover me." And I don't know if this is meant for the mother or platoon he keens for, as his dream-caught legs churn his sheets into white cloth froth. I focus on my daddy's scalp and make this ritual my sole duty. I watch his eyes close, his creased brow go smooth. This is my way I bring daddy home from the war.
Wow. Again, another masterful work.
Thank you.
How has your idea of what poetry is changed since you began writing?
Good
and what
question.
It can do, and what it can do.
I think it's changed, especially in the realm of not just – I've seen what it can do as far as putting out a book and realizing how – and once I thought, okay, scratch all that. So at one point, I was sitting in a workshop that I used to – regular workshop. I used to go with a group of poets with the poet Tony Medina after his poetry class at Howard. And one day he said, all right, you do realize that when you write a poem and you publish it and send it out, it's not yours anymore. And I was like, what are you talking about? I wrote it. It's mine. And I debated for a long time about that. I said, there's no way that poem's mine. I wrote it, which means it's not yours anymore. I just didn't believe it. People tried to tell me, no, Derek, and they're trying to explain. I was like, nah, it's mine. It's always mine. But then I realized as a reader, the pieces that things that writers have sent out, that I take it and take as my own and mold it and shape it into maybe – mantras in my life or understanding and things like that. So to there's certain poems that I feel are mine. It's like there's songs out there when people go, ooh, that's my song, or they're playing our song, you know, you claim it. And so it's been interesting to watch and see my idea of poetry, thinking, oh, this poem is mine, you're just borrowing it, but then realizing and watching how the work of the poet can be claimed. And I mean that in the best way, of people taking it into their hearts and in their homes, reading poems for, you've got poets that have been dead for over 200, 300 years, and people are reading their pieces at their weddings or at eulogies. And to me, it's like that's the idea that the poem is actually, and I just lost the word, but the poem is actually, it's just something that's active. It's multi, I can't even think of the term, but it's something that's always useful. It's a multi-useful thing. It is a part of the community, and it can affect people. It can move people. It can make people enraged. It can also take you places as well. And also as a teacher, now I watch as I see students who, I see students that are just getting, really getting, when they get an idea of how poetry works for themselves and they see themselves in it, to me that's when I was like, that's how poetry can change someone. Just as I've also seen students that have no use for poetry or have gone through poetry, and regardless of their experience, they leave it. Like, that's not for me. So I've seen how poetry can also be discarded and such. But I can't think of a place where poetry hasn't changed someone or something or the landscape or even changed the mood. I mean, I hosted an open mic for over 10 years along with a poetry series. And to sit on the stage and watch, you know, people in the audiences connect with all sorts of writers or go up and be like, you just told my story, or have a bit of a problem with the person who wrote it. They're like, I think this is offensive, and I want to talk to you about that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's I think that's what it thinks. And so I think that's how poetry has – my idea of poetry has changed for me. It's, there we go. It's multipurpose. It ain't just –
multipurpose.
It's not just books in the library. It's not just dust. You got folks performing, you know, taking it, you know, to film, taking it to young adult novels in verse. I mean, you've got so many writers who are poets who are now are really doing their thing along with some mainstays of the young adult world. And now you got kids who are reading young adult novels, but they're in verse. I think about Elizabeth Acevedo, Kwame Alexander, definitely Jason Reynolds, and so many other folks who even taking it to the children's book realm, Tony Medina, Ruth Foreman. So, yeah, it's there. It's out there. Poetry can reach you. You know, nobody – I love the movie with Brian De Palma's The Untouchables. Not
yes,
just like that. Like nobody,
that
nobody's un, yeah, no, and like nobody's untouchable. And I feel like poems are like that. You know, nobody's untouchable from poetry.
Wow.
You can run. You can run. You can't escape.
You can't escape.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've come to the end of the hour, if you can't believe
oh,
it.
Oh, wow. Can't believe it.
Yeah. When people hear your work, the very last question, they usually want more, I'm sure. What's next for you as a poet?
What's next for me as a poet?
Yes.
Definitely another book. Actually, I have two. Wisdom Teeth came out in 2011. I have a chapbook and a larger volume of poems with two other poets called On All Fronts that came out this March. But there's a larger book coming. And I think it's time to really utilize my voice in several different ways, you know, especially moving into the realm of audiobooks and voiceovers and things like that. But what's next? Stepping up into a larger realm as far as teaching, whether that be a university or stepping into like some sort of arts institution. Hint, hint, National Museum of African-American History and Culture. So if y'all hiring, here I am. So,
and they're listening
that.
Too.
Got that? Yeah.
Listening.
Also, yes, there you go. But yes, I think that's what it is. And maybe that, and I think also it means recording and archiving other people's stories, because Well, the future is always is. I think it's there's always a sense of uncertainty, but and as we kind of lose our, you know, the masters and our and you know the our Yodas, our matriarchs, you know, you're like, oh my gosh, you know, you think about Diane Carroll's gone.
Yeah, she's gone. It's true.
Prince is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Toni Morrison is gone. You know, Baraka's birthday was just a few days ago. So we think about these openings, like what are we doing to save, you know, to save these voices. Not only that, what are we doing to hold space for folks to come in? Sometimes I think maybe two or three people are going to have to come in to fill the spaces that, you know, these celestial bodies, you know, these planets of literature have left. But mm-hmm. I think that's also a thing. They left that big space, so they've left more room for more people to fill it. Some people say, oh, you can't fill those shoes. I'm like, well, what if this means the shoes are so big? That means it's going to take a whole lot of people to fill it. Mm-hmm. Maybe look at it that way. So that's where, hopefully I made some sense. But, yeah, that's where I see myself headed.
I'd like to thank you for being a guest on Quintessential Listening Poetry. I really enjoyed listening to your work and listening to you. I mean, you're full of bright ideas, and that's what we should all be about.
Oh, well, I'd just like to say thank you for just reaching out for having me. This is really, really cathartic. I really needed this. It's just a pleasure to have this much time to share my work and to also meet you. And it's also good to know,
okay.
You know, repping North Carolina, that's always great. So, you know, High
North
Point.
Carolina.
And Charlotte, you know, hey.
Charlotte.
Yes.
Well, you know I want you to come back on the show again, so just be on the lookout for another invitation. So keep that in mind.
Most definitely.
All right.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, have a great evening. And to the listening audience, good night to you all. Good evening.
Good night.